Welcome, everyone. So before we return to our talk by Master Empty Cloud on Zen practice, we always begin with if anyone has any questions, please, if you're new or old, it doesn't matter, don't be shy. If you have any questions about the practice of sitting, walking meditation, mindfulness practice in general, and most importantly, anything to do with how you bring the practice into your daily life to create happiness for yourself and others. If anything is not clear to you about how to do that, or if there are specific situations in your life that you're dealing with that are kind of giving you a challenge, please don't be shy about asking a question. So does anybody have any questions about practice? Yes. In 2 minutes of less or less. So the question is, could I talk about the Buddhist practice of surrender? Actually, I think in Buddhism there isn't any concept like surrender. So you, when you say surrender, Doug, you mean what? I mean, what do you...
Surrender, the... Probably what I'm talking about, the messages of the ego.
Yeah, okay. So Buddhism has a lot to say about the self, which we also call the ego. In Buddhism, there's no word for ego, but there is a big word for self. But because in America we sort of use self and ego sort of mean the same thing, self-centered, egocentric, we kind of talking about the same thing. So in Buddhism, one of the most fundamental delusions that people like us hold on to, as was just said in the verse, how did you say, can we let go of a belief in a delusive self? Okay, this delusive self, this ego, this self that appears solid, appears real, appears to be something, but Buddhism says, no, this is a delusion. It is not real. Now, we might say, you know, if it was all very benign, we'd say, so what? Okay, you know, there's lots of, you know, it's like the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. I mean, we can say holding on to a belief in that is not injurious. I mean, even if you held into that belief into your adulthood, you may stand out from your peers in terms of your belief in it, but it's not a harmful delusion, is it? You know, it's kind of sweet, isn't it? Childlike. But the strong belief in our self-identity as a separate self is a source of suffering. Because if you think about all the development of fear, anger, greed, desire, loss, gain, you know, et cetera, right? That's all based on a self that is either gaining or losing, liking or disliking, loving or not being loved, worthy or unworthy, right? There's an I that is the center of all that, right? And so having a strong sense of that, you know, I am me, and I am permanent, and I am real, and I am self-existent, gets us in big trouble, constantly. So because of that, Buddhism says understanding the nature of self, and learning how to lead a more selfless, altruistic life, a life that is not based on self-centeredness, not only is kind of a saner way to live, right? Because if the self is really an illusion, a delusion, then running our life based on it is mentally ill, right? It is an illness. But it also causes great disturbance in our life. But more importantly, one each of us knows personally, usually, but also in terms of the world and history, that people who tend to be more selfless, people who care about others as much as themselves, people who are as concerned with others as much as they are with themselves, people who love others as much as they love themselves, including, let's say, animals and plants and the earth and things like that, tend to be what? Happier. Right? So it is not simply a matter of, you know, leading a selfless life sort of remediates our own suffering and our own kind of emotional pain that we're always creating for ourselves, you know, on just a daily little picayune basis, and also in terms of the big ones that constantly disturb us inwardly. But leading a selfless life is usually a happier life, a more carefree life. Right? Usually when we are totally wrapped up in ourself, totally concerned just about myself, my suffering, my drama, you know, the hypochondriac who's only concerned constantly about their body. You know? You might want to say to them, why don't you care about other people's bodies too? You know, other people are ill too, right? Right? That doesn't mean not to care about your body, but don't be so obsessed by it. Because you are not alone. We are not alone in anything, right? Now, getting back to Doug's, that was kind of a preliminary. So, once we kind of begin to understand this, right? Just what I was talking about, have some, even intellectually, has kind of looked into this whole thing of self and ego and what it really is, and does it really exist, and sort of has an intellectual understanding, this might not be the case. But also when one has done enough personal reflection that one sees that one's egocentricity is a source of suffering to oneself, and that having an altruistic, loving mind is a source of happiness, right? Then what do? You know, until we come to full enlightenment where a selfless, altruistic way of living is natural and normal, right? That is a Buddha. He's not working on it. She's not working on it. Okay? The self has been totally uprooted and seen through. So the Buddha is totally able to be present and loving to everything and everyone. Right? But even if we have some insight or belief in, we have long histories, each and every one of us, right? Of living through this tiny little chink of self, of looking at the world through this tiny little self, 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 me, Fred, right? And that's kind of the default of our minds, right? So often that is kind of our first, our first reaction in situations, relationships, et cetera. But if we are really clear about how we want to live, right, then we have to let go of that. Now, let go, understands, is just what you're talking about, Doug. To let go implies what? That you're holding on, right? So first comes the awareness, I'm holding on to something. I'm holding on to myself. My viewpoint, my ideas, my needs, my wants, right? Me first, my pain, my hurt, right? So one realizes one is holding on to that. How does one realize that? We all know why, right? Because when you're in that egocentric state of me and mine, even if it's around a thought, a feeling, or whatever, it is very what? Constricted. It's very narrow, it's very tight, there's a feeling tone to that, right? As well as we realize my mind is upset, right? I don't have equanimity. I don't have spaciousness. I don't have an open heart. When we're in our ego state, our hearts are what? Very closed, very narrow. Get away from me. It's all your fault, right? Poor me. Right? Poor me. As if we're blameless, right? I mean, we are so delusive, right? I mean, there is very little that people haven't done to us and we haven't done to somebody at some point in life, right? And yet, in our self-righteousness, we feel like we're the victim of things. So again, when we are clinging to self, right? When that seems to be natural and normal in the moment, can we learn to know better? And to let go. Even though in the moment we want what? We want to keep the drama going, don't we? We want to be right. Right? And we want somebody to pay for it. Right? In that moment, the practice is, am I willing to let go? And to do what? To see it from the other person's perspective. How about that one for a start? Right? Am I willing to just see life through the eyes of this one other person? Right? Now, obviously, as we develop, we begin to willing to see life through everybody's other perceptions and realize everybody's got a different take on things. Right? But in that moment, am I willing to let go? Surrender to that which I know is true and right and best, even though there's a small little narrow part of me that wants to what? Hold on and milk this suffering for all it's worth. Right? So that's, I mean, the practice is a willingness to do that. To get out of our little self, to get out of the little narrow, constricted me, I, that little dictator that each of us cherish, who often rules our life. And are we willing to be more expansive? When we do that, we are surrendering to truth. Because the truth is what? There is no one way. There is no one truth. Right? We're all in this together. My pain is your pain. Your suffering is my suffering. Now again, please understand, this does not, you know, be very clear. What I'm saying is, I understand that your suffering is equal to my suffering, right? This is not a absolute denial or diminution of one's own self, okay? Right? I mean, each of us have feelings too, or perspective. But we no longer think it's the right way, or the only way, or the true way. This is very important. So I'm not saying, oh, you know, just be a doormat for everybody and agree with what everybody says, and, you know. It's important that you don't walk out of here and go, oh, now I'm going to be a selfless person, and, you know, I won't have any thoughts, any opinions, any feelings. All I'll do will think of others. Now, again, if you were a fully enlightened Buddha, I would say wonderful. But because most of us exist still in the world of self, we have to be human. So we're saying, I'm willing to acknowledge myself, but I'm I'm going to stop being self-centered, right? Self-centered means I'm only centered on myself. What's altruistic, or what's another, I don't know. What's a good word? What's the opposite of self-centered? I mean, because it's not really other-centered. It partly is other-centered, but it's sort of other-centered including the self. Right? Like myself is just one of many selves. Right? So when they're giving out the relief supplies, you know, even though I'm hungry, I realize everybody here is hungry too. Right? So I don't push everybody else out of the way so I can be first. You know, we're all in this together. I don't always have to be first online. I don't always have to be the one who gets through the red light. I mean, the green light. Doesn't get stuck at the red light. Somebody's got to, right? Sometimes we're first, sometimes we're last. Sometimes we're in the middle. It's okay. Any other questions? Thank you. This is a very good question. So the question Jerry asks is, he's got a friend that works in a difficult situation in terms of immigration and whatever agency, whatever he works for, he realizes the most difficult cases, often the most ones that are really nothing can be done about, seems to be the ones that are come his way, and obviously it's very difficult for him. And Jerry brought the point of that term that's used these days, compassion fatigue, right? People who are in situations where they have to be continually helpful or compassionate, you know, do you burn out? And is it okay to take a rest? You know, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is Thich Nhat Hanh. I think everybody knows Thich Nhat Hanh, he's a source of inspiration to many of us. During the Vietnam War, he founded something called the School of Youth for Social Service, which involved eventually up to 10,000 young people high school and college students who basically were involved in social work, social welfare work, refugee work, orphanage work, community building work, in the midst of the war, when obviously everybody else, the two sides, were primarily involved with killing. They had this wonderful youth movement. A lot of hard work, a lot of difficult work. You know, they were often working right in the midst of the war zones. Endless work. You know, you could work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and still not make a dent, because it was probably, it's like being in Pakistan today or in Haiti or something. You know, it's just it's endless, the suffering. In the midst of that, as Tai was kind of the spiritual head of this movement, he instructed these young people in the School of Youth for Social Service that every week they needed to take a day of mindfulness. Interesting. He said, you must do it. Right. It wasn't like a break. It wasn't like a weekend, you know, like an opportunity to catch up on your email and, you know, run errands. It wasn't like that at all. It was like a necessity if you were to be able to do your work in an open, compassionate, wise, caring way. Because he knew that if anybody continues to do that kind of work over and over, you know, without an end, their compassion will dry up. Their anger, their bitterness, their despair, their fear could easily overwhelm them. And he was always someone. You know, even though the School of Youth for Social Service, we could say, was like a social welfare, social work group, it was always based on Buddhist principles, which meant it wasn't only about the good work they were doing, and they were doing good work, it was also that you were bringing to these people caring, calmness, the capacity to offer them fearlessness. And to do that in the midst of a very, you know, I mean, without going into it, they worked in war zones. So, you know, bombs are going off and things like that are happening. There are raids and all that. But as well as they were often mistrusted by both the competing sides. Because since they were not either pro-Saigon or pro-NLF, for those of you who remember the Vietnam War, both sides, well, if you're not with me, you must be on the, you know, with the other side. So they would often, there were killings. Many were of the students, not many, but a number were killed, murdered. So anyhow, in the midst of all this, Thich Nhat Hanh said, you must put it all down one day a week and have a day of mindfulness. A day of mindfulness was not just like a day of retreat. You know, it wasn't just sitting, walking, meditation, but it was also slowing down, putting on some fresh clothes, taking a long bath, taking a walk in nature, preparing a lovely meal, having it with friends, you know, taking some time to do extra meditation practice. It wasn't so, again, it wasn't just a formal day of meditation. It was really a day of coming back to oneself. And he felt it was imperative that anybody doing this kind of work have at least one day a week where they just put it all, again, you know, I mean, you know, we put it all down and we veg out in front of the TV. You know, that's kind of our thing, you know. I'll just, if you're a guy, you know, just what? Watch sports and drink beer, you know. I mean, it's not that kind of day that he's talking about. It's not just a day where you just put it down, right? Don't think about it, but it's a day where you do things that are nourishing to your sense of humanity, to your sense of, he felt strongly that you had to, even in the midst of those circumstances, somebody had to keep alive the sense that life was beautiful, right? And there were beautiful things in life. Or else it becomes what? Awful grim. Awful dark. Awful hopeless. So, yeah. So this was in the 60s, or 70s, but I'd say 30, 40 years later, the same truth is true. People who are in this kind of work need, and you know, because people will often say, oh, but isn't that selfish? You know, we just talked about, isn't that selfish, right? No, it's not selfish. You know, if you want to really be there for these people who are suffering, right? If you want to be able to offer them not just a thing, you know, like food or a skill or something, but offer them the goodness of your presence, right? Then you have to have it. And it, you know, you, it, to have that capacity, one has to take time. I remember when I visited Thich Nhat Hanh and the others in Paris in the 70s, when they were very much working around war issues and refugee issues, and constantly in Paris were bombarded with letters, phone calls from Vietnam that were all just, you know, one tragedy after the other, right? One tragedy after the other, and needs, you know, orphanages and refugee camps. There's no food, no medicine, no, you know what I mean? Just, can you help us? Constantly like that. The suffering was overwhelming. And I would often see Thay just go for a walk. Thich Nhat Hanh. Let's just go for a walk. Very sweetly. And let's just look at the trees and the sky and enjoy. You know, let's have a cup of tea and just enjoy. Let's sing. Often he liked to sing. Right. Let's do things that nourish us. It's very important. You know, right now, I know there are a bunch of you here, some of you here who are members of the community and are in, right now we're having an intensive, a 12-week, we call intensive period of practice. It's based on Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Happiness. I recommend it to everyone, even though you may not be in the intensive. I certainly recommend that you get a hold of the book and kind of follow along with us. In this book called Happiness, many of the very simple but very meaningful practices that Thich Nhat Hanh has developed in his last 20, 30 years in the West are explained and shown how to practice. And it's really the same. A lot of the practices in there are just what we're talking about, each of us. You know, many of us lead difficult lives. I mean, I don't know, as, you know, compared to what's going on in Pakistan and Haiti, I don't know if that's really true. But it is difficult for many of us. It's stressful. Many of us are juggling things. There are financial stresses, personal stressors, having to run from one thing to another, right? I'd say the same thing. We need to find time in the day, but especially we need to find time on our time off to do just what we're talking about here. Your daily meditation practice, sitting, walking practice, your breath practice, your coming back should be that time during the day that restores you. Where you just put down that which we take so seriously. Many of us are addicted to our jobs. addiction is not a pleasant thing. It's a difference between social drinking and alcoholism, right? Like that. You know, workaholism, we take it all so seriously. Again, I'm not saying we all have to work. Hopefully we all have professions that we can enjoy or find meaningful, and hopefully we do a quality job. But we are obsessive and tight, and we worry and we struggle, and our life gets out of balance. We need to have balance so we can give quality part of ourselves to our work, but also quality parts of ourselves to our relationships, to our families, to our communities, all necessary. If you let your work eat you up, that you have nothing left over, things are out of balance. It could be the nature of the job, but oftentimes it's just the nature of the way we approach it. Peace of mind, harmony, open-heartedness, right? These are not extras. These are necessities. Right? Please, we should all look deeply into our lives. Now, again, some of us have more freedom than others in the choices we make. But even within the choices we make, there is freedom, how we go about things. And within our own mind, we have lots of freedom. Even if the external situation is difficult, our minds do not have to be difficult. And that's an important freedom that meditative practice gives us. When we learn to train our minds, when we learn to liberate our minds from that which would cause suffering to ourselves, we can work and be in difficult situations and not be tossed about by them. Let me just, a little bit of Master Su Yun. So those of you who've stuck with me for all these weeks know that we are we're actually only on the second paragraph of the, what, about week six or eight or something, so anyhow. For those of you who have been here know that we're dealing with this very simple discourse, wonderful discourse of this master, Chinese master who lived to be 120, born in the 1840s, died in the 1960s, the most illustrious Zen master of modern China. And this is called the Method of Practice. The last 4 weeks we've been dealing on the four prerequisites. I won't even go into them. I wouldn't mention them because I may go off on them, and I don't. I promise to keep going. But he says the essentials of now Chan practice after doing the prerequisite. He says the first thing one needs to know is how to regulate one's body-mind. If they're not regulated, harm can come to one. He says walking and sitting meditation in the Chan, Chan is Zen, C-H-A-N is the same word as Zen, are for the regulation of the body and mind. And then he he says a couple of things. First of all, he talks about taking a posture. And I think all of you know about this. Some of you came from the orientation today, but those of you who know that it's good to find a posture that is stable, that is grounded, where your back is erect, and you feel comfortable in. So it's important that you find a posture for sitting that gives you that sense of groundedness, stability, and that sense of, it's a mountain-like quality. You feel solid, you feel grounded, connected to the earth. So that's important. Then he says, in terms of your mind, when you begin your practice, you shouldn't have an anxious, agitated mind, nor should you have a dullness. The mind should be very clear and very alive, alert. If you find that your mind is agitated when you start your meditation, stop, he says. Put everything down, including all your efforts to practice. Rest a few minutes. And then start again. Okay? So again, and you've heard me say it before, when you sit down to practice your meditation, don't just zoom. A lot of people think, oh, they come in with their mind, they got a mindset, they sit down and they just keep it going. When you take your seated posture, chair, cushion, wherever, home, here, stop. Right? Check your mind, check your body, feel yourself in the posture, get centered, be relaxed, grounded, check your mind, make sure it's relaxed, it's not sleepy, it's not dull, nor is it racing. If it is, take a few moments to quiet yourself, calm yourself, okay? You're not wasting time. Again, one of the things we are doing in what we call meditation is very simply we are learning how to be with ourself, and we're learning how to relate to ourself in a healthy way, and we're especially learning how to relate to our body and mind in a healthy way. And we want to learn to develop a responsive relationship with our body-mind, right? When we tell it, calm down, it what? It calms down. When we tell it to let go of something because it's agitating us, it what? It lets go, right? Now many of us have a mind that doesn't listen to us. It does whatever it wants. That is a scary situation. If you really don't have good self-awareness, if you are somebody who says, gee, I don't really know myself that well, and at the same time you say you're somebody that has a mind that won't listen to it, I don't know. What you're saying is, as a stranger running your life, and you have very little control over it, if that's what your life feels like, I'm glad you're here tonight. Because the practice of mindfulness, the practice of meditation, allows us, enables us, teaches us how to be with ourselves, how to be with our body, mind, and how to establish a caring, responsive, intelligent relationship. You know, a good relationship. You know, it's a good relationship. If you have a good relationship, if you have a good friend, right? You're not fighting with them all the time for who's in control, right? You're not always, it's not always about, you know, domination and submission, right? Now, you may have friends like that or relations like that, but I would probably say it's probably not a good one, right? Good relationships are what? Where there's harmony, right? And even though there may be differences of ideas or opinions, you know, we work it out with mutual respect, right? You know, dialogue, right? If you don't have that kind of relationship with yourself, please work on it, right? So the same way people, you talk to people and they say, well, I'm working on this relationship with this person, you know, their husband or wife or significant other, colleague, you know, we're working on this relationship, you know, that's where we talk these days, right? Please check your relationship with yourself. It may need some work, but it's very important work. It is the most important work. Because if you are not happy within yourself, if the different parts of yourself are always in battle, struggling, right? There is no inner harmony, is there? There is no inner peace and there will be no inner joy. It just cannot be. The same way if you're in a relationship with somebody, we are always in conflict, right? We know what those kind of relationships are like, don't we? They're not happy. And the individuals in them are not happy, are they? No. So please check your relationship with yourself. Is there harmony? Is there mutual respect? Is there caring? Is there compassion? If there isn't, please work on it. So that's what he's saying. I mean, I'm just taking it. He says, there are many experiences that you encounter when you're doing meditation, too many to speak of. However, if you do not attach to them, they will not interfere with you. If you encounter or perceive an unpleasant experience, take no notice of it and have no fear. If you experience something pleasant, take no notice of it and don't give rise to fondness. Okay, now this is a very kind of unique thing, we would say, about Zen meditation, as perhaps compared to other systems. Other systems make a big deal about the things that may happen as a meditative experience. Right? You see colors, you see lights, you have a vision, you know what I mean? Swirling lights go about and, you know, you hear celestial music, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of meditation systems make a big deal about this. But not Zen meditation. It doesn't say don't have them. But it says none of that's important, because what's important that we're cultivating is equanimity, right? And a spaciousness of mind that does not attach and grab at or push away from anything, right? So if you have pleasant experiences, good. If you have unpleasant experiences, good. It's like that. Don't make a big deal about anything in your practice. Just keep the practice going. Right? Sometimes you'll sit down and your body will be at ease. Wonderful. Sometimes you'll sit down and your body will feel painful, a little constricted. That's fine. Right? It'll be different next time, right? Sometimes you'll sit down and your mind will be very peaceful and at ease and wonderful. Sometimes you may sit down and the sitting is difficult. Your mind is agitated. That's fine. Sometimes you'll have deep meditation, sometimes you'll have shallow meditations, but all these different terms we use. Again, in this practice, we're learning equanimity. Right? No more thought of right and wrong, as was said earlier. So in our sitting meditation, good feelings come up, painful feelings come up, altruistic thoughts come up, totally self-centered thoughts come up. Just watch them come up and watch them go. Do not attach, do not grab at, do not judge, do not evaluate, do not push away, do not struggle. The Buddhist path is a path of nonviolence. It's non-aggression. We need to learn to be that way with our minds, our thoughts, even our memories. Are there any questions about this? So that coming back, you can see why in talking earlier, when we talked about the posture, we said seated like a mountain. When you're seated like a mountain is solid, mountain is grounded, and a mountain is not disturbed by the birds that fly around it, is it? The mountain is not disturbed by the small animals that are scurrying around on it. Right? It's like that when you sit like a mountain. Thoughts may come and go, memories may come and go, feelings may come and go, but you're not disturbed. Your mind is open and spacious, aware. You're cultivating equanimity. So this is what Master Empty Cloud is suggesting to us. And then when I come back in 2 weeks, the next section is called How to Start the Practice. So this has all been preliminary. Right? The 6 weeks we talked about law of cause and effect and observance of the mindfulness trainings, faith in one's own capacity to awaken, choosing a Dharma door of practice, and getting the body and mind right. This is the foundation. And now we're ready to practice. So in 2 weeks we'll figure it out. Any questions before we end tonight? Yes. Huh?
Omnicenter,
like omniversal, omnicenter, all. Yeah. Is that a word, though?
Sure.
No, I mean, it has a nice meaning, but do people actually use that word? I mean, is that?
I wouldn't see why not.
Oh, okay. So you're proposing it. It's sort of like Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, interbeing, that word. That's his, it was his own. Omnicentered, good. So thank you for coming.